start on time.
We'll talk. Let's do it after this.
I want to walk. Rep Senator Fritz. Good. We're going to do your bill first. Rep Senator Fritz, we're going to take you first. Yeah, I want to welcome you all to the committee. I know it's Homeless Advocacy Day. How many of you are here for that? Looks like a lot of you are. Well, there you go. Thank you for coming, and it was nice to meet you this morning at the rally. And welcome to a part of watching your government work. A good example of that work is at the table right now. Rep Senator Fritz has got a bill that is going to make the world a little bit better. So with that, Rep Senator Fritz, do you want to move your bill and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I would like to move House File 592, I think, to be included. And I also have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we, it's in the packets, members, and you want to move your amendment?
I would. The O-136 amendment.
You want to describe it for us?
Yes. What the amendment does is it narrows down some language for the bill. We have narrowed it down to hospital emergency department. We're trying to get the methodology and allow up to 60 days post-hospital discharge based on the specific identified emergency department visit and frequent flyer user who is participating in care coordination within a health care framework. And that's what this amendment does.
Any questions about that? Let's vote on it then. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment's adopted. To your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the one of the reasons today, other than along with this amendment, is to talk about the fiscal note that you asked us to get. And I want you to know that we are just about there. We have been working with the department, and I would like to, if I could, ask the department, Dave Greenman, to come down. We've had a couple of meetings with them, and I wanted him, if he could, come and speak to that. We should have the fiscal note by Friday.
Very good. And then any chance we can get Mr. Greenman to come to the table makes it a good day. I can't believe they haven't got this note, and it's the only fiscal note they have to work on now. They've just been over there. And how are the coffee and afternoon tea times going? Pretty well? They're up to their neck. Now, for the audience, the department's up to its neck with a tsunami of requests for fiscal notes. And so if you can give us a little update, Mr. Greenman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. We have been working with Representative Fritz and the advocates on this bill. We got the amendment yesterday and have been what we need to do in order to do the fiscal note is we need to pull some data to look at who in our MA population fits this criteria that would qualify for these services. And so in order to do the fiscal note, we need to pull that data, and that's what we're doing right now. And we're going to continue to work with these folks based on the criteria in the bill, and should have a fiscal note for you by Friday.
And Mr. Greenman, do you expect that it'll save some money?
I think it has a strong potential for savings.
I do have that chart I could show you again if it would help. Oh, yeah, there it is. Thank you. I appreciate that. So we're urging you on to a great success with this fiscal note. Any questions for Mr. Greenman? The more the better. Okay, well, I guess nobody wants to ask you a question, Mr. Greenman. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Greenman, I'm just looking at the bill and line 1.15. And that notion of 15-minute increments in terms of a payment mechanism. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a question for maybe Mr. Greenman or the others, but is that, can you talk about whether or not that is the typical payment mechanism for social workers?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't believe it's currently the mechanism that's used. I think we would need to look at some other way of doing this reimbursement, but I think we've had some discussions with Mr. Harder and Representative Fritz, and I think that's part of the discussion, I think, is the reimbursement mechanism.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Murphy.
Thank you.
We've already heard this pretty thoroughly in the Health and the Forum Committee, so, I heard it here. That's right. I'm late over. That's right. I'm sorry. It's all blur. I'm sorry. Any other questions members have about the topic? Representative Fritz, do you want to say something? Or Mr. Harder, since you've come, do you want to at least say hello?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing us to come and your support on this bill.
Thank you for that.
I want to commend DHS, though. Yeah, you're welcome. But I do want to say DHS has been very engaging to work with on this, and we do see their real potential that they'll actualize the savings. We'll run the numbers. These amendments help us refine that. And, Mr. Chair, can I leave you with just my latest bit of information statistically on this good bill?
I do want to hear more about it, please.
Well, so this bill primarily is focused in residents within Steele County, and as you saw on your sheet last time we were here, the hospital alone, and you have a letter to this from the CEO of the hospital, have a cost avoidance or cost savings of $272,000. I have received certified numbers from the county-based purchasing plan by which most of these individuals on Medicaid will have been covered under. They took 14 of those 24 individuals, did a one-year pre-post, and in addition to the $272,000, they've booked a $216,000 claims paid difference as well. The average of the frequent users, their average per member per month cost is $1,200. The average non-frequent users is $18 per month.
Thank you. I think Mr. Greenman is taking notes up there with all this to take back to his department. So good to have you here. And so do you want the last word, Representative Fritz? And we'll hold
thank
it over.
You. And in your packet, I hope that you do have the letter from the Steele County CEO Hospital, from the CEO down there. And if not, I have copies up here for your information. And thank you again, Mr. Chairman, members.
And Anoka County likes this, too. So I think a lot of counties would like this opportunity. So with that, it's laid over. Thanks for
thank
coming.
Thank you.
Mr. Harder. Representative Thiessen, do you want to come down? Nice to have you back. It's like there's an empty chair here that we have to.
Thank you for having me back.
I'll move your bill. And is this for inclusion, for possible inclusion? So it's the bill is moved and before us, and welcome
and
to the committee.
Amendment 2, Mr. Chair, a DE1.
And I'll move the DE1 amendment. Do you want to explain that to us, please?
Well, I can explain. It's basically the bill. So if you want to adopt it,
let's just do that and get it in order. And then all in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. It's adopted. Welcome to the amended version.
Thank you. I want to start out by saying I'm here in my individual capacity as a representative today.
Good to have you back.
Yes, I'm pleased to be back. Actually. I sit in the back corner there every once in a while and watch.
Yeah,
so
we see you sometimes.
Yeah. So this bill has to do with Medicaid for long-term care, and so it affects nursing homes, it affects the elderly waiver, it affects alternative care program in the state. And kind of the background is briefly, and I don't want to spend too much time on the bill, but federal law, it kind of distinguishes between what we call community spouses, who are the people who are not in an institution, and long-term care spouses, so those are the folks that are actually in the institution, and allows community spouses to keep a number of assets. This bill is not dealing with the asset part of it, and also allows community spouses to keep basically their income. The income of a spouse in long-term care, if the community spouse's income is under a certain level, which is set at between $2,700 and $2,800 a month, money from that the long-term care spouse, so the spouse that's in the institution, any income they get actually goes to their spouse before it goes to pay for long-term care until you reach this threshold of $2,739 a month. Okay. So basically, we've said that what that kind of tells us is that this is the standard of an acceptable living standard. People can get by on $2,740 a month, whatever. And I would note, just for kind of larger purposes, that's a bigger amount than most of our public employees get in their monthly pensions. So we'll just set that there. What this bill says is that's perfectly appropriate. We want to make sure that community spouses can stay in their homes, can live independent and dignified lives. But it also says that if you're going to be making, if you make more than that, if the community spouse makes an income that's higher than that, so you're making more than, and what this bill says, starting at 250% of poverty, if you're making more than that, you should at least pay a share of your spouse's long-term care costs. So it charges a fee like we do in TEFRA, which is a different program, but uses a similar mechanism to have the community spouse, so the spouse that's not in the institution, actually pay a share, starting at 7.5% of their income above the threshold level, going up to 33% of their income when they get up to 500, 600, 700% of poverty. In fact, even maybe higher than that when we get to 300%, or 33%. And so that's kind of the gist of the bill. you know, so really what it is about is about, you know, families taking responsibility for themselves, personal responsibility, this idea, you know, when you get married, that you're in it for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. You know, that's what everybody says when they get married. We want to, I think, believe that that's the case. And I think most Minnesotans believe that that's the case and are willing to pay, you know, to help pay for the long-term care needs of their spouse as opposed to making the taxpayers pay for it. I mean, that's really what this comes down to, and freeing up money to do stuff like the folks in this room today would like to have services for homeless people, right? The most needy. You know, Medicaid is intended to be a safety net program. It has become, in this state, the program, it's become long-term and short-term care insurance for 40% of Minnesotans. That was never the intent when this program was founded, and it's not really designed in a good way to be a long-term care program for most Minnesotans, because it requires you to spend yourself into poverty, right? And so one of the things this bill is trying to do, and it has two mechanisms. There's the fee. It also requires, when someone is applying for long-term care, that they're given some information about what that means in their lives. So there's some notice provisions that are given to long-term care recipients as well. So it's really to try to change the discussion around Medicaid as much as anything else, and give incentives for people to actually be saving for their own long-term care. Now, the other part of that discussion is that we actually have to get incomes to people that they can actually save on, right? You can't require someone who doesn't make very much money to save. So the last thing I'll lay out before questions is just to the fiscal note. This fiscal note shows a cost here, right? There are ways, and we've been talking to the department, to change the numbers so it actually does do some small savings. And I think when we talked about this bill before, Mr. Chair, I told you it wasn't really a savings bill. That wasn't the idea of it. It's really to change the mechanisms and the incentives around Medicaid so people start thinking about it not as the default long-term care program, but start saving on their own. But we could change the numbers to actually generate a little bit of savings for you, and we can talk more about that later. The other thing, two other things I'd like to observe. One, you'll note that the department acknowledges that they have very little information about who actually might qualify for this. Last summer when we started talking about this, they said that there's probably 400 to 500 cases that would fall into the group that would be charged this fee. In the fiscal note, that's down to 55 people. You know, if you're talking 400 to 500, it's a much different program, and probably the savings would be somewhat larger. The other thing I'll say, 55 people are going to be covered by this. The department is asking for 4 employees to administer a program for 55 people, which seems to me to be outrageous. And so I think we can actually, you'd actually see savings if you just had one person. I don't even know why you'd need a full-time person, but one person administering a program for 55 people in the state seems sufficient to me. So I will end with that.
Well, I appreciate that. Maybe you and Representative Joskowski can work on the staffing side of that. While you work on that, that's also just a little personal comment. But anyway, questions for the author? And there's a testifier, too, I think. Maybe we'll have the testimony. But I think you're onto something. And the whole thing is, how do you push people to be responsible for themselves and to buy long-term care insurance and all those things that we know are the behaviors that make sense for the long run?
Right.
And I appreciate you bringing this forward. Nicholas Osborne, are they? Oh, hello, sir. Yeah, come and pull up a chair. And
there we go.
Oh, got to give me the comfy chair, though.
Yeah, they're both.
Well, welcome, Mr. Osborne. We have a couple minutes to hear from you, and thank you for coming today. And you attracted quite a large audience. They must have known you were going to be here.
Appreciate it. and I'd like to thank Mr. Albers and Ms. Kiffmeyer and all the committee members for inviting me to come. I had about 6 pages of stuff I wanted to cram in here, but I thought what I'd do is just give you a little breakdown on what we have. My wife is a retired school teacher. She got her retirement 3 days before she was going to actually retire. She had a stroke. I took care of her for about a year, and before she had another series of strokes that took her into a nursing home. That was been about 5 years ago now. She's received all kinds of accolades. She was even given Teacher of the Year Award by Jesse Ventura. It would have been nice if you would have shown up, but you know, we'll take what we can.
That's also a different story.
Yeah, well, that's a different story. I personally am an ergonomist. I design for disabled people and for the elderly. I help people get out of their car and get into their house and get up the ramp and move around their kitchens and bathrooms. That's what I do. I have a long experience in all kinds of different design, and we won't go into that. But basically what I thought I'd do is break this down for you so you understand what we're talking about. I do not get Social Security, although I could, but I would have to turn it back to the nursing home 100%. So I'll start out with what we get. Retirement and Social Security for my wife total is approximately $3,700 a month. The first few $1,000 of that goes to the nursing home. Up until lately, the second $1,000 of that goes to insurance. Now that's health insurance. So now we're left with approximately $800 for me to live on. Out of that, we got the heating, water, all the utilities, all those good things. Hennepin County property tax. And that brings us down and down and down and down. Then we have things like doctor bills, my doctor bills and her doctor bills. I'm disabled. I've never taken SSDI, but I've always tried to pull my own weight. Anyway, by the time you add it all up, I'm left with approximately $100 a month to live on. Because I've had to give up our business, my wife and I had a couple of businesses over the years. I have no other source of income other than these two. So we're getting pretty desperate, and I frankly do not know what to do. And I'm hoping that this bill will help push us along. I do want to get back into ergonomy and start working again. So I suppose I'll leave it open to any questions anybody might have. Or other than that, kiss my wife every night, tell her I love her, tuck her in nice, and make sure that she has the TV set turned to the station she loves, and which is usually the Animal Planet, and off to home I go.
Thank you, Mr. Osborne. Any questions for Mr. Osborne? Well, I think you would encourage us and inspire us, and thank you for your story. And would you greet our wife on our behalf? Actually, you'll be on TV. I think this is on TV today, so you could show her.
Which way is the camera? Hi, Mom.
Yeah. So you can actually go online and pull it down. I think this is productive, and I think Representation is going to work on this fiscal note. I can't imagine 84 people to run this program. So we could actually make him run it on one and make that our fiscal note going out of here if you want. So we can talk about that, just to remind them they don't need four people to run 55 cases. Any other testimony, Representation, you want the last word before we lay you over?
I guess I should say one more thing.
Okay.
If I may. I have been rebuilding the house, trying to get my wife home, and quite frankly, I've run out of funds. I'd like to turn the basement into apartment living, but I can barely afford to put the roof on the garage. So, as a matter of fact, I don't know if I'm going to be able to. It's been a tough 5 years, and I thank you all very much.
I can't imagine. Anyway, thank you for absenteeism. Do you want to say anything else?
Yeah, I think we've gone through just a couple things. There is a hardship exemption in the bill, you know, so people could apply for that. But I think this case illustrates kind of how the need to prioritize a little bit. I think that the testifier, you know, certainly isn't making the income where this would start to kick in. And so that clearly is a need that we need to meet, and we need to figure out the best ways to make sure we get the money to the folks that really, truly need it. So that's all. Thank you for hearing me, and I'm glad to be back.
Rep. Thiessen, just since we're doing work here in public sometimes,
it
makes $93,000 in the first year and $275,000 after that. If Ms. Aves had drafted an amendment to limit their staff to one for this, it'd become neutral, and we could put it in our omnibus. I think we'll do that, and If you would be okay with that, I think that would be my suggestion.
I'll leave it to you now. Hopefully okay. I won't have to return here for a while.
Well, it's good to have you back, and it's nice to come as another representative here. So with that, the bill is held over, and there's instructions to staff. Okay, Representative Anderson. Yeah. Yeah, who wants to move the minutes? Representative Hayden, thanks for coming.
Welcome, sir.
You're, just to the audience, Representative Hayden is one of our hardest workers, and he loves to approve the minutes as well. So if you'd like to make that motion, any questions about that?
I'd love to make that motion and thank you for the compliment.
For the we all get along here pretty good, at least till next week. So any questions about the minutes? All in favor, say aye. I opposed. Hey, we're agreeing on stuff here. So, and we've put aside about 25 minutes or so for this whole segment. So if you can kind of organize your time within that, Representative Anderson. So if you want to move your bill and tell us what you're doing. And
yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 846 to be included in the omnibus bill. And this is a bill regarding housing emergency shelters and transitional housing money. And housing is a key component for people to be stable and for their ability to be able to have a job. These emergency shelters meet the urgent needs of people and who are homeless. The shelters provide people with a safe, temporary place. Transitional housing programs and emergency shelters are effective and efficient in rapidly connecting people to appropriate housing and mainstream services. There is a need for transitional housing. People have episodes of homelessness that are due to an economic crisis and or the inability for the family or individual to identify appropriate mainstream services. So these are really a great way to help in helping people stabilize their housing. The success of transitional housing programs rests in the fact that participants are provided with affordable housing, support services, and the requirement to pay rent, be good tenants, work to increase their income and access mainstream resources to address issues that may be causing their instability. And then whenever possible, we should prevent homelessness. Prevention is less disruptive to a family and community. It also saves taxpayers money because we know that it costs far less to keep a family and individuals housed than it does to rehouse them. When homelessness occurs, we must ensure that it's brief and that people who experience it reintegrate quickly back into the community. Minnesota's emergency shelters and transitional housing programs are operating fantastically with this philosophy and this approach. And now, Mr. Chairman, I have some testifiers with me today.
Yeah, please, any order you like, you can tell us who's first.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm executive director of Elam Transitional Housing and a founding member of the Minnesota Coalition, the National Coalition for the Homeless, and MICA, which is the Metro Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Mr. Chair and Representative, for joining us at the rally this morning. Your words were incredibly inspiring, and thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Two pieces that you have that were handed out. One is an overview of the number of people that are experiencing shelter, experiencing homelessness in the state. This is done by Wilder Research Center every 3 years. And then you also have some information on Elam Transitional Housing. What we've seen over the years is continued growth in the number of people experiencing homelessness. This is primarily due to people's inability to afford the housing that may be available in the community. It tends to be an economic crisis first, and then it may be other issues that they may need to address also. I'd like to again thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill to fund shelters and transitional housing programs. Here in Minnesota, God has blessed us here in Minnesota with all these great people in the room that you see, many of us with our yellow tags on, and all the great work that they do in helping to prevent people from becoming homeless and to assist people that are homeless get back into housing. Certainly, the legislators here, our governor, faith communities, providers, people who have experienced homelessness, local governments, for-profits, nonprofits, in developing a humane and cost-effective system to really assist people to prevent them from becoming homeless, provide shelter when they need it, but then also to transition people back into housing and back into jobs. Minnesota has been a national model since 1984. That's when we passed transitional housing legislation here in the state. It was modeled after our program, Elam Transitional Housing, which we started as a church-based shelter, and then it was a transitional housing program in 1983. And we have over 100 transitional programs in the state. And the reason it's a model, because it's really helped us to limit the number of shelters that we've had to create in the state and to really assist people to stay in their housing or to help them move back into housing as quickly as possible. As I mentioned, Elam has been around since 1983. We serve over 6,000 people a year. In this information, you have a number of different stories. And I think the reason that these programs work is, number one, is that we really listen to people that are at risk or experiencing homelessness and design the models around helping them. And with that we treat people the way that we would want to be treated if we were in that same situation. And for those of us of faith, we believe that how we treat the least of our brethren is how we treat our God. We have a couple folks from Elam here. Ann, and I don't know where folks are. Ann is a veteran that's in our program right now. Barb Snyder came into our program through a foreclosure of her farm. So there's a variety of reasons that people are experiencing homelessness. Second reason why these programs work so well is that it creates flexible models and resources so each community may design their own response. Our real goal is to help people stay in their own community where they're close to their network of friends and people so they can stay there and move on with their lives. The public, faith, private, nonprofit coordination of funding is critical and is a critical piece to making this successful. The third piece is accountability. As Representative Anderson mentioned, is that the expectation is that people do pay rent. That's in the transitional housing law, that you have to pay 25% of your income for rent, that you try to get a job if you're able to work, that your children are in school. So we're not duplicating any resources that are available in the community, but rather utilizing existing housing in the community. Much of it is for-profit owners and landlords that own that property, and then moving people into mainstream resources in the community, as we were just talking about in the Medicaid programs and other programs, and assisting people to get jobs and making sure children are in school. It's extremely cost-effective. If we can prevent somebody from becoming homeless, we know in our family homeless prevention program, it costs $500 to $750 per family. For shelters, it costs about $36 for a single person to be in a shelter a night. For a family, it's about $118 for a family of four to be in a shelter. Now, that may seem high, but you'll hear testimony in a little bit about how much it costs to have folks in other systems. For transitional housing, it really varies around the state how much it costs. For Elam, it costs less than what it would cost us to have somebody in a shelter for 2 months. We can house somebody for a year. So obviously, if we can transition people very quickly, we're saving taxpayers' dollars. So together, with God's blessings, we can maintain, and we do have the funding in this state, to maintain a humane and cost-effective system to prevent homelessness, address immediate needs of people experiencing homelessness, and assist people to transition back into housing and jobs and other services that they need. The current base funding for these programs is $688,000 for emergency shelter. That only funds 14 shelters in the state of Minnesota right now. Over half of them are in greater Minnesota. For transitional housing, the current base is $5.86 million. That funds 64 transitional programs across the state. 33 of those, or over half of those, are in greater Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And who's next?
We have Beth.
Mm-hmm. Do you have four more witnesses?
We have five total.
Okay, yeah. So if you can do about 3 minutes apiece, you'll all have a chance to say what you want to say. So thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much for inviting me. My name is Beth Broman. I'm the executive director of a homeless shelter called Dakota Woodlands. Dakota Woodlands is the only family shelter in Dakota County. We also shelter women and families from Scott and Carver counties. In 2010, we provided shelter and supportive programming to 103 households. That's 244 individuals, which was out of that was 125 children. 96% of households we served reported their last permanent address before coming to Dakota Woodlands was in Minnesota. And for 56% of the individuals, it was their first time homeless. Dakota Woodlands coordinates carefully with others in the community, including homeless service providers, businesses, communities of faith, foundations, individuals, and federal, state, and local units of government. We are happy to say that 86% of our residents do move into stable housing. Dakota Woodlands is a supportive force that many of our residents never had in their lives. It is impossible to quantify the value of an encouraging word when a mom ensures her child is getting to school every day, or a child brings home an improved report card. Even a compliment on appearance or for the meal they just prepared can create confidence and self-worth. Dakota Woodlands has the advantage of being with the residents every day, becoming a family that cares and worries about them. Our approach, not unlike the approach of many shelters and transitional housing programs throughout Minnesota, includes tough love. Residents must fulfill program requirements, attend various educational opportunities, such as financial literacy instruction, parenting classes, responsible renter course, and healthy lifestyle instruction. They must also reliably keep their appointments with their county-appointed service workers, such as social workers, psychologists, and counselors, and medical personnel. They need to meet with their children's teachers and attend to their children's needs at all times. When needed, Dakota Woodlands does provide child care for residents to make it easier for them to fulfill the social and education requirements, including to fund their GED instruction when pursued, even after they leave the shelter. As one resident stated, Dakota Woodlands doesn't take care of us because they had to. They did it because they love us. When a household leaves the shelter, Dakota Woodlands makes every attempt to keep in contact with them, introducing them to community connections that will continue to assist them in their recovery, including them in family activities such as picnics, community art, school functions. Recently, we created a fund to assist former residents with emergency expenses, diapers, formula, small loans, and other immediate needs that could fling them back into homelessness. Last biennium, Dakota Woodlands did not receive state funding due to a lack of funds. We hope this time it will be different. Thank you for your consideration of this bill. Your assistance is essential for Dakota Woodlands in programs such as ours.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have Rick.
Hello, Mr. Podvin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I thank you for your time today and offer you my respect and best wishes in your daunting task in the context of the significant state budget deficit. The budget deficit that I experience day-to-day with my clients is the increasing scarcity of affordable housing and living wage jobs, which sets the stage for homelessness faced by about 13,000 Minnesotans. For the past 21 years, I have managed transitional housing for the Diocese of St. Cloud, targeted to male veterans, women with children from the St. Cloud area. And our program is a small program, typical of greater Minnesota programs that really would be hurt significantly by incremental cuts to funding. With two staff, hard to cut 25%, 50%, and still maintain a program. So I think that's a factor to be considered as we move forward. I have had the privilege to encourage our clients to hang on to their dreams, work hard to make them come true. Most of them have been without much in any way of a positive support system. Most of them have done their best, and it has not been enough. The challenges of their journeys are many. They include single parenting, poor health, lack of reliable transportation, lack of education and health care, mental health disorders, no support system, and domestic violence. The cumulative effects of these challenges over time are often poor credit history, poor rent history, sometimes criminal history and chemical dependency with probation and child protection involvements. If they are to be successful, they need more than can be offered by compassionate volunteers. Our case files average about 500 pages by the time our residents move on, with a success rate of about 85% with average lengths of stay of 6 months. They need the help of skilled professionals who know how to motivate and help them set high, attainable goals and hold them accountable to these goals. Our program participants pay 30% of their income as a program fee. and an additional 45% of what to what we call their long-term stability plan. For a mother with one child on the MFIP program, that leaves about $110 a month for discretionary spending, including diapers, personal hygiene supplies, and transportation costs. This is about the same as a mileage reimbursement check for one round trip from Austin to St. Paul. Depending on individual circumstance, these funds are either placed in savings to cover first month's rent and security deposit, or are used to pay bills and improve credit and rent histories, so landlords will more likely say yes. We ask our graduating residents to write anonymous letters to our new residents. Excerpts include, "There is more hard work to be done. I know you can do it. After restoring my credit, buying a house is my new goal. You made a great decision to become a Doma's transitional housing resident. Congratulations on starting your new life." The comments go on and on. The value of transitional housing is not what we do for people, but what we enlighten, support, and expect them to do for themselves. The housing contracts we develop with our clients make it clear that we expect them to use community resources and get results that will make them better renters, better students, better employees, better parents, and valued members of the community. To be defined not by what they need, but rather by what they can and have become. They will work hard for this if it is possible, if they have hope. The hope of a simple, decent life. With the continued investment of private donors and taxpayers, the statewide system of professionally managed transitional housing program can do this. I ask only that we offer this to them. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. And welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, instead of Chris Arneson, we have Robert Allen.
Good morning, Mr. Allen, or good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Rob Allen, and I'm a deputy chief in the Minneapolis Police Department. Minneapolis is no different than the rest of the communities in the state of Minnesota. When our citizens see someone lying outside, they call 911. Depending on how the caller describes the situation, the dispatcher will send the police and EMS, or the police, EMS, and fire rescue. There's a tremendous cost associated with all of those calls. The good news, though, is that there are a lot fewer of these types of calls in our state because 3,500 men, women, and children were in emergency shelter or transitional housing last night in Hennepin County, primarily in Minneapolis. Fewer citizens called the police out of concern for a homeless victim of crime. Fewer citizens called out of fear of someone on the street, whether that fear was warranted or not. While the majority of those in need of emergency housing are children or law-abiding citizens, our patrol officers, paramedics, and fire rescue personnel deal with the consequences of some of the public issues of homelessness. Should we see a reduction in funding for emergency shelter and transitional housing, I'm concerned about the time and expense that will result for those of us charged with serving and protecting the community. And I'm even more concerned about the increased cost to taxpayers for sheltering people experiencing homelessness at other facilities. In the vast majority of cases where we are called to check the welfare of a person who is homeless, we need to find them shelter. If homeless shelters at a cost of between $10 and $35 a night are not available, we end up sheltering them at another location. When a pair of beat cops must process one person to spend the night in jail, the cost of the officer's time plus booking in a bunk is over $500. One person for one night. If we transport the person to the emergency room, a workup and night at the hospital cost taxpayers $2,800. If we bring the person to detox, taxpayers are paying $192 a night. We know that in order for change to come, homeless people need access to social service providers who can assist in long-term change. We also know that people who are homeless are far more likely to be victims of crime or to become perpetrators of crime. That crime has a very high cost to our taxpayers in police, prosecution, defense, judicial, and incarceration expenses. We save our taxpayers a considerable amount of expense by having an effective system of homeless shelters and transitional housing. One model that the Minneapolis Police Department has seen great success with in the past 6 months is the Downtown 100 project. Partnering with St. Stephen's Human Services, Salvation Army, and the City Attorney's Office, and the downtown business community, chronic offenders of mostly livability crimes received intensive attention, including emergency shelter and supports to move into housing. In 6 months, the arrests of this group of chronic offenders reduced by 74%. Imagine our time saved and the money saved by taxpayers. Instead of 100 arrests, we had 26. I think we can all agree that the community values the time of men and women who serve as police officers, firefighters, and EMS personnel. I hope you find value in our support of maintaining funding for emergency shelter and transitional housing. Having homeless people safely housed each night allows law enforcement to do the real work of protecting and serving from the real danger on our streets. Thank you.
Thank you. You just have done an especially good job. We usually don't applaud, but that was pretty good testimony. So. Well, good luck on trying to do as well as that, sir. Welcome to the committee. Don't feel the pressure. Are you Mr. Wolf?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, a tough act to follow, and I know your time is valuable, so I'll be brief. My name is Mike Wold. I am a lifetime resident of Minnesota. I live in Eagan, Minnesota. I've operated a small business there, a small consulting business there for over 10 years. Prior to that, I had about 25 years of experience, primarily corporate world in various technical and management positions. About 10 years ago, I started getting involved in affordable housing. I became a volunteer for MICA, Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. There are over 100 churches that are involved, and I guess to tell you the truth, in the beginning I got involved because I love this country, and I couldn't stand to see a country where people are sleeping under bridges. So I got involved. So my heart brought me into it, but then being a business person, I started looking at the numbers, and you've seen some testimony. It became very clear to me with the research I did that this is when you invest in affordable housing, you're going to get big returns. It can be up to 10 times the return for the dollars you spent. So that's the basic reason, you know, I'm involved. I believe in these programs. In specific, I was looking at the emergency services program and realized that, first of all, it's proven very effective, but also at $33 a night, that's less than I paid at the Motel 6 in Colorado on one of my trips. So, I mean, we're talking about pretty low-cost housing compared to going into a hospital, going into detox. Relative to the transitional housing program, that's the first step, really, for individuals and families to begin moving to self-sufficiency. If you go over to the Dorothy Day on any given night, you'll see over 300 people there sleeping on mats on the floor. That's the first step. Then you get it. You get into, and sometimes it's emergency services. The next step usually is transitional, and then transitional gears you more towards permanent housing, subsidized, and then beyond that the next step in the continuum, permanent housing, unsubsidized. What impressed me about the transitional housing programs is they're showing 89% success rate for those completing the program. So you're not just a good investment, but it's an investment that's cost effective. Finally, the last thing I wanted to say is one of the things I've learned in my journey is that you can't just provide a home for someone. There's a support system. The people that are into those situations, there's a reason they're there. You have to investigate why they're there. You have to deal with employment counseling. You have to deal with job placement. You have to deal with assistance in permanent housing. Otherwise, that investment's a waste of money. So if you don't add on these services that are provided by both these programs, then your investment isn't being protected. Bottom line, I believe that affordable housing programs, particularly these ones, are just good financial investment, and it's also the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's the end of your testifiers. Do you have anything to say, Mr. Anderson? We'll take it to questions after that.
We can take questions now.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the officer. Please don't leave. I got a question for you. Thanks for your testimony today. And I just wondered, you know, as you know, local government aid, especially to the metro area, is proposed to be severely cut. I'm just wondering, does Minneapolis also provide funding just from city funds for the shelters, for transitional housing, or if you know? I don't know if you're the right person to ask, but
Mr. Allen,
how is it funded right now?
Someone can answer that question, too.
Yeah. Way to broaden the discussion, Representative Liebling. This is. Welcome,
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wald. Committee members, Sue Watlow Phillips, Executive Director, Elam Transitional Housing. City of Minneapolis does have some federal dollars through the emergency, what used to be called Emergency Shelter Grant, now called the Emergency Solution Grant, which is funding through the federal McKinney-Vento. They use those dollars primarily for rehabbing shelters and transitional facilities right now. They have in the past used some federal community development block grant dollars and community services block grant dollars. In Hennepin County uses property tax dollars to help fund some transitional housing programs as well as some shelter, too.
Representative Liebling, is that good? Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Anderson, thank you for bringing this forward. We have been, unfortunately, dealing with the issue of homelessness for far too long in Minnesota. I am curious if you know, or if your experts might know, what would be the cost of an appropriation, what would be the appropriation necessary to close the gap completely on ending homelessness in Minnesota?
Ms. Watlow Phillips, you just want to take a crack at that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the cost of closing the gap is really a cost about creating enough affordable housing and livable incomes and having the mainstream resources there. We cannot create enough shelters or transitional housing to deal with all the folks that are at risk or experiencing homelessness. One-third of the population in the country and in Minnesota are one paycheck away from becoming homeless or not being able to make their mortgage or rental payment. So I think our goal has always been, and as I helped bring forward the legislation back in the early 80s, is how do we prevent people from becoming homeless? How do we have the limited number of shelters that we desperately need to help people be safe and not die on our streets? But then how do we transition people back into housing? With that said, as I mentioned before, the current base appropriation, which is what the governor has recommended, is $5.86 million for transitional housing and $688,000 for emergency shelter. Elam Transitional Housing is promoting an increase to $8 million for transitional housing and $2 million for emergency services grant. Will that fully fund what we need? No.
I just did some quick math. I remember there was a housing project at some point that was quite commended 6-8 years ago. And it was a couple hundred million. I just did, if you divide a couple hundred million, 200 million by 50,000, which is lucky you can get something that cheap, that's only 4,000 sites. So, anyway, Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, I appreciate that. It seems to me that 2 or 3 years ago, there was legislation introduced that had a price tag of $42 million or so to deal with homelessness and supportive, not supportive housing, but housing with services to really put an end to the chronicity of homelessness in Minnesota. So somewhere between $200 million and $5 million seems to be the answer, but I guess $5 million is probably not going to solve the problem for now. Correct.
Well, and if you're some rep, if your target audience is 13,000 that the Wilder paper references, the only chance to help that is a strong economy and good jobs for these folks and some place to live and all the things that you'll spend your career discussing. Anyway, so I appreciate this discussion. Other members' questions? Well, I think this is, do you want the last
Chair,
one?
If I could just add just one more thing. I think the one thing that we do know is we do know how to invest in housing for those of us that own homes. And so currently we spend, by not collecting in revenue through the mortgage interest, over $411 million plus dollars a year on subsidizing those of us that are homeowners. By the second year of the biennium, we will be at $500 million or half a billion that we will be investing in subsidizing homeowners through the mortgage interest deduction, that we're not collecting those that revenue. So it's not that we don't know how to do housing in the state. It's that we are putting the housing dollars towards folks that already are in homes.
And I think we won't go down that road very far. So anyway, do you want the last word on your bill, Representative?
Yes, I'd like to thank everyone that's here today for the Homeless Day on the Hill and for all my testifiers. And I hope they have presented a really good view for you of what's currently going on out there and how important this housing piece is for people and keeping people out of poverty and really a need that's needed for people just to help them just a little bit to get them back into the workforce and into a stable environment. So just want to thank you for this time and would appreciate your support.
Thank you, and the bill is laid over. Before all the people leave, something dawned on me when that other fellow was there, that Mr. Osborne fellow. You know, there's an example of a person who's just one bill away from a mess, and maybe there's some people in one of your associations who would like to help him, like go help him finish his basement off. If anybody wants to, I mean, I just felt like saying this. Maybe they could call my office at 296-1729, and we would in some confidential way put you in touch with him if anybody wanted to do a good thing for this an incredible man that we met who was an example of the kind of face of Minnesota. So anyway, thank you for a very nice hearing. And thank you for all the public who came today, the advocates and the workers, and thanks for all your good work. So Representative Huntley, let's do your bill next. You have a witness who's out of town. And welcome to the committee, although you've been here all along. So,
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 689.
Okay. What'd you say?
I would like to move House File 689, and I assume you will move to have it laid over.
Right, and maybe we'll set our guests leave. Thanks for coming today. Okay. Remember, the government belongs to you all. The more you come, the better we do. So, Huntley, I think it's quieter now, so go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, this relates to a group called Teen Challenge, which is a residential drug and alcohol treatment program. It's been around for a long time. In fact, they started out with teens, but now only about 15% of their clients are teenagers. And what they're asking for is and by the way, you all know that one of my big things is measurement, and they have actually had the Wilder Foundation come in and look at their results, and they have pretty dramatic results in improving the lives of the people they treat. What this bill would do is, for those of their clients that are in general assistance, currently, if you're on general assistance, you can make up to $150 a month, and then after that, the money goes to the state. This would increase that to $500 per month, and it also increases the amount of a savings account that they can establish from $1,000, which is the current limit, to $2,000. Both of these items are intended to encourage their clients to work, save money, so that when they finish the program, they can have a little bit in their checking account. So I'll turn it over to the witness.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Dennis Bradshaw. I'm the director and dean of MIN of Minnesota Teen Challenge, Northland Campus in Duluth, Minnesota. Representative Huntley really has said a lot of what I was going to say, though I don't think I have to repeat it. This issue basically is to allow the men to A, get a job, and B, have a savings account that would enable them, upon successful completion of a 12 to 15 month in-house, strictly supervised program, to then be able to pay for rent, food, and possibly transportation. Many of the clients have issues with driver's license and things like that that they have to pay money for. Currently, if they receive more than the allotted amount, They are in danger of having to pay all of the group residential housing back to the state. So that is our request, basically, is to allow them to get a job late into the program. Again, it's a 12 to 15 month program divided into four sections. This would not really go into effect until either the last month of the third phase and all of the fourth phase, which we currently use as transition.
Well, thank you. Questions? Can you just tell me how many, this will actually make a positive difference, at least for a few of your clients, right?
Yes, we wouldn't. We would only offer this to the clients that are really looking to have a full recovery. We know in every program, there's those that are very serious about it, and those that don't take the program all that seriously. Just to refresh, or just to tell you that the program has required academic daily classroom or group studies. Also, throughout the year, they have seven contracts. The contracts consist of books that they must read, articles that they must read, and also memorization. They're required to have seven of these contracts completed before being able to graduate. This would go to the student that has all of that ready to go.
All right, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Bradshaw. So something intrigued me when you said that there would only be a select group of individuals based on what you, if they were following the model that you felt appropriate, that would be able to take advantage of this benefit. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I guess, and Representative Huntley, that concerns me. I'm not quite sure that we should be changing statute, making a law to increase a benefit to someone that somebody arbitrarily, with great respect to you, Mr. Bradshaw, on the great work you do at Teen College, but you or someone else in that position gets to make the decision to do. And so I would say if we were going to change this, that benefit should be for everybody who is receiving those services so that they can get to that point and that they would be the decision makers of how they use the money, or frankly, we just don't do it and we keep it at its level. But I am greatly concerned, unless I'm just reading this wrong, that we would start to change statutes that then subjectively would put this into an agency's hands on if someone would receive this benefit.
Well, Mr. Hayden, I'll let you react to that.
Well, Mr. Chair and members and Representative Hayden, when I first heard about Teen Challenge probably 18 years ago, I was not really enthusiastic about it. And I've come to learn that not everybody can fit into the same program, and you have to have different programs to treat different people. And they have a system that the people that get into their program, and most of them have failed in other programs before they ever get to Teen Challenge, need a very strict environment. They have to live up to that. And if they're successful, their outcomes are very good compared to the rest of the treatment programs we have. So while I might not agree with everything, for the individuals in their program, their system works, and I think we should support it.
Representative Hayden.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, Mr. Bradshaw, I don't deny that we have different treatment programs and different programs throughout the state that fit different people, and I don't even have a problem with Teen Challenge's curriculum around accountability and being very strict. I think the objection that I have is that we have a state benefit that Mr. Bradshaw and his organization or others get to arbitrarily or maybe not arbitrarily but subjectively for sure decide if they get that benefit or not. And so my problem would be that I think that anyone receiving that was enrolled in this program would be able to get that benefit regardless to if the person who is supervising their treatment gets to say so. So I'm not having an issue with Teen Challenges or anybody else's curriculum. I'm just challenged by us kind of putting this particular decision in their hands.
And Ripson Hayden, maybe I'm missing something, but I think that everybody at some point would go over to the point where they could actually be adaptable to work. And so I think that if you've, I mean, I know you've met with Teen Challenge, and there was one young man who had been through 19 treatment programs that I met, which seems like a lot. And so if I had to be working with that fellow, if I somehow that was my job, and I'm not good at that, but if I had it, I would certainly say, well, let's do something a little different than what we did before. And so maybe we're not going to, you're going to focus on whatever I think we should focus on to get well enough to be able to maybe survive this time to be successful. And I think it's just a matter of timing. And so in the third and fourth stage of their particular program, they deem that people are healthy enough to take on outside work and not focus on the internal program. Is that what you're getting at? And you're concerned that that timing of that freedom is in somebody else's hands? Is that
maybe I need to know more about it. I just kind of something triggered in me that just said that, you know, we're going to kind of move forward and change the disregard or change the amount of money that people get, and we're going to change that law. But the application of that process seems to be somewhat selective to me. I mean, quite frankly, people, there are, you can go to Hazleton or Turning Point or R.S. Eaton or any number of treatment centers that said that they got somebody at a particular time in their life when they decided that this was the time in which they made the change. So I'm not saying that Teen Challenge doesn't figure that, you know, doesn't get people that do that, but all treatment centers, depending upon, you know, where the person is in their recovery, when they make a decision that they're actually going to try and do this, they make that change. I guess where I'm going is that I'm just a little concerned about the notion that some people would get the benefit and some people wouldn't get the benefit based on a particular, and let's not use Teen Challenge in this instance, but a particular counselor or administrator of a treatment center says so. So that's my concern.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, could I?
Please.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden. This would be directly related to their completion of the requirements of the program. So as they complete the requirements of the program, keeping up with their academics, keeping up with their contract work, and also eliminating any disciplinary difficulties, they would automatically fall into a place where they could receive this.
So I'm not sure that. Representative Huntley?
There's a fiscal note, and it's $15,000 in the first year, $3,000 of which is to reprogram the department's computers, so the ongoing cost is $12,000. So we're not talking about a lot of money here, and it's not just for people at Teen Challenge. Also, other people on general assistance in other programs could be treated the same way.
Right. Yep. Representative Hayden?
Yeah, no, Mr. Chair, I think that Representative Huntley has alleviated my concern. I just want it to be applied across the board and not necessarily just a particular a particular individual gets to say that. So enough said about that. I just, when I heard him say it without looking at the bill, that's where my sermon came from. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
I like your opinions. So it's helpful. So anything else? Anybody else in the audience wishing to comment about this? I guess we're down to the Sonny get the last word, I guess.
Well, it's become clear to me over the years that treatment programs have to be keyed to the individual, and what's good for one person may not be good for another.
You don't get the last word. I forgot. There's Representative Kiffmeyer has a question, and I apologize for forgetting.
Well, Representative Huntley, I think you're making your point very well, and I think that also was actually one of my questions I had, that it is broader than just for the particular testifier. But I think also when Elam Traditional Housing testified here, almost all of those programs, when they testified, they do have a program and have some conditions. Matter of fact, that's key to their success, is that there's a balance between giving and the responsibility and working them into the point where they're on their own. They have training wheels, you might say, for a while, and then you want them to be able to transition right out into being on their own. So I see this consistent with other programs that we have here, too. But I think your specific answer, Representative Huntley, and you always get the last word, no matter what. Thank you.
Do you want the last word, or you want to quit while you're ahead?
Last laugh.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming, sir. And with that, the bill is held over. So, Representative Mack, And timing is working out perfect. Thanks for all the witnesses being so succinct and to the point. And Representative Mack, the balance of the time is yours. You have about a half hour, and I think that should be pretty good. So welcome to the committee queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That should be more than enough time. I would like to move House File 806, and I believe it will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Yes, that's correct. That's the right motion.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, what you have in front of you today in House File 806 is a county simplification and streamlining bill. There are a number of provisions put together in this bill. This was brought forward to me by different county organizations. Basically, a lot of you, if any of you have been in touch with your county commissioners lately, I'm sure you have been, you understand that the complexity of administrative requirements across human services poses significant challenges to counties' ability to meet the needs of the clients they serve in a timely fashion. As a result of the current economic climate, county caseloads are increasing dramatically, while resources to serve needs are decreasing, which is exacerbating this issue. The proposals in this bill are one piece in helping counties to increase their effectiveness and efficiency in delivering services at the local level. And members, this is something that came to my attention over the past 18 months, talking to some of my county folks in Dakota County, getting a better handle on just the depth and complexity of not only the programs that we have, but how they get administered, and just the peer administration process, how it can really bog down the ability to get the services to the people that need it the most. And so that is really what encouraged me to get involved in this process. This is one piece of probably many that need to be addressed in order to better partner with our counties to make sure that they're able to deliver the services that the state is providing through our appropriations and such. But just to give you a very brief overview, and then I have some testifiers here who can speak in much more detail, but basically a few things in this bill. This bill will authorize electronic verification for eligibility determinations in the child care assistance, child enforcement and general assistance, as well as a few others. And this will also require programming of MAXIS to automatically apply child support payments entered into PRISM, which is the computer program used for our child support cases. Requires health plans to accept a billing format identical to the MMIS billing format. Aligns the overpayment look-back period for MFIP, General Assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, and Food Support. It allows counties and health plans to provide health plan information mailings in alternative formats. And requires the Commissioner of Human Services to develop recommendations to align eligibility verification procedures for all health care, economic assistance, food support, child support enforcement, and child care programs, and requires the Commissioner of Human Services to develop a simplified process to redetermine eligibility for medical assistance, Minnesota Supplemental Aid, food support, and group residential housing for recipients who are expected to experience minimal change in their level of need. And so, like I said, members, we have testifiers up here that can answer questions, specific questions, as well as they're going to go into a few specifics. And Representative, or Chair Abler, excuse me, I just realized I do have a technical author's amendment that I'd like to move to get the bill in shape.
Why don't you move that then?
Okay. I would like to move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
And do you want to describe it, or is it just technical?
Extremely technical.
That's good enough for me. Anybody got a question about that?
It just keeps the language consistent throughout the bill and consistent with statute.
Well, we want consistency. So all those in favor of consistency, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the consistency. Okay, thank you. You've
thank you, Mr.
adopted. And so let's hear the witnesses. And then is there a fiscal note that's coming about this, too?
Not to my knowledge at this point.
Oh, but it's in the works, as I understand it. Mr. Green is not here to describe how hard they're working on this one, but there's other staff here, so. Okay. Greenman's off the hook for this one. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our researcher tells me that it just came. Their fiscal note was just issued, so I guess none of us here has it yet, but apparently it's been issued.
Okay, we're going to go look for it. Anyway, so does he have it?
Yes.
If he wants to share it, we can get that at least. So anyway, let's do the testimony, and we'll let the fiscal people figure out that. Welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you, Chairman Abler and representatives. I'm Paul Fleissner, Director of Community Services for Olmsted County. And today I'm representing the Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota Inter-County Association, and Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, and anyone else who's out there, I think. Anyway, related to this bill, I think I was asked to testify because my holy grail for many years has been administrative simplification and public assistance. And I've been about as successful as the Knights of Nee from Monty Python, if you know that particular movie. But I think there's a real opportunity and a real need here. I don't know if this committee is completely familiar with the Minnesota Healthcare Connect study done a few years ago, which highlighted the complexity of this system, which we're drowning in right now. But that particular study showed that we had the third most complicated system in the nation. I believe it said we have over 26 programs and 16,000 decision points. You add to that the fact that we have a DOS-based system, green screen, that basically DHS can't even hire people to program anymore. What you see in front of you, I sent a handout around. On the top of it, it says Fiat. That's not a European car we're talking about. In our world, that's a four-letter word that stands for workarounds that we have to do by hand. There's several pages there, and that's from 2006. As I said, I've been on a journey here, and when you have a system where we've got record numbers of people coming in for assistance, you have a non-automated system, you have the third most complex system in the state, and you haven't modernized, we need bills like Representative Mack's bill to make this system work. And as we look at another example I'll give you that I offered to the Administrative Simplification Committee a few years ago, is a very simple one. We had general assistance medical care, we had Minnesota care, and medical assistance. Each of them has a different way of determining the value of a car. Does that make any sense? No. And so we have to fix some of these policies so we can move forward and serve people in a better way. And on top of that, you add the caseload growth in our county alone. We've grown 21% since 2007. We've added a half an FTE in that area. And we've gone through some business process redesign to try to keep up, but we really need some help in simplifying policy and modernizing our technology. And with that, I'll turn it over to the real expert, Mary, on the actual programs.
Well, Mr. Fleissner, you just want to, I don't know who Uncle Harry is. There's a food support for Uncle Harry tip sheet. Is that when Harry is not behaving? And
Mary could answer that better
than
I.
Doesn't really matter. It's just
I know that's like hieroglyphics here, but those are all the codes related to certain programs, certain little statutes that this body over time has passed that aren't programmed into Maxis. Every one of those is a hand workaround that our workers have to work. And that's a list from 2006. I've been carrying it around because we've had no success at streamlining, modernizing, or anything else.
You should have done some handwriting on your workaround sheet so you're working around the workaround. Anyway, I think you're making your case pretty well. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to come and talk with the committee. I wanted to start with a little bit of background about
Say your name.
I'm sorry, I'm Mary Nelson from Ramsey County Human Services. I'm the director of the Financial Assistance Services Division. I wanted to start with a little bit of background about why this sort of bill is so important to my staff, who are the financial workers who try to make this system work. Our caseload in Ramsey County has grown over 8,000 cases in the last county, has grown over 8,000 cases in the last 2 years. Now, the story will be a little different for every county in the state, but the theme will be exactly the same. A lot of caseload growth with no additional staff. We haven't added any staff, so I'd actually like to have that position. You added?
It'll cost you.
Yeah. And the growth in our caseload, frankly, has mostly been in the areas of food support and medical and not as much in the cash areas. So clearly this is a reflection of the economy and a reflection of the recession that we've been in. Our caseloads now average around 500 per worker. That gives a worker very little time each month to deal with changes and things that happen on each one of those cases.
We've made a lot of changes to try to make our operations more efficient, and we'll continue to look for ways to do that, but frankly, we need help. We cannot do this by ourselves, working with the complex rules and systems that we have. This bill can help to assure, at least in some ways, more accurate and efficient processing of the work that we have to do. So when we talk about things like electronic verification, verification is very, very time-consuming for our staff. By moving to a system that's electronic, and many states already do this, it's when you use existing databases to verify the information that you need to do. That means that my staff or the client don't have to go out and try to gather the information, that it's done electronically. That not only makes it a more efficient process for us and for our participants, but it also really assures that we're going to be using more accurate information, and the benefits that are issued are going to be the appropriate benefits, and that people are eligible for the benefits that they're getting. The automation of the application of child support is something that has been that I've wanted to see some change in for a very long time. What happens now is that our staff, for every MFIP child, when a child support payment is made, our staff get an electronic message. And they have to convert that electronic message and literally load it by hand into our Maxis computer system that serves our MFIP participants. We've estimated that automating that so that the system was automatically updated would save us a minimum of 3 staff. That's a lot of staff considering the caseload growth that we've seen and the fact that we haven't gotten any additional people. We're talking about just trying to keep up with the caseload growth that we have, and clearly this is an area that could give us significant help. The issue in here around the MMIS billing format for the mental health and elderly waiver services, that really has to do with making it easier and more consistent in how bills are sent in to be paid by the health plans. And I think about this in terms of a number of years ago, the state did not have a centralized payment system for the child care payment system. What that meant in the metro area was that if you were a child care provider in the metro area, you could have 5 different bills you had to deal with every month because you were getting them from 5 different counties. The same thing happens now with trying to bill to each of the health plans when they each have their own statement. So this is another way that we can sort of standardize things and make it easier for people to submit their bills and to not spend as much time in the claiming process. You already heard about the overpayment look-back period with the language correction. This really is an effort to make this simpler so that it's not as confusing for staff, so that it makes it easier to someday perhaps do a more robust eligibility engine than we have right now. The same thing would be true of the aligning eligibility verifications across programs. Again, making it easier for staff to understand the programs, to remember the programs, and to someday have a more robust eligibility determination engine. The health plan mailings, it costs us between $5 and $6 a packet to send information out about health plans to our participants. I estimate that it'll cost us around $30,000 this year in Ramsey County to do those mailings.
Right now.
Being able to provide these in an alternate format is a way that we clearly could save significant money and a few trees along the way as well. We want to be careful as we move in this direction that we don't make the administrative tracking of this more complicated than, or so complicated that counties opt to mail anyway, because I don't want to have to add a staff person for my $30,000 that I save in mailings. And then the final thing that's in the bill is the issue around simplified redetermination for stable income households. A lot of our elderly and disabled participants have very stable incomes. And if they don't, they're on Social Security. We already know about the increases they get in those programs. This is an expansion of a pilot that they did in Hennepin County where they actually, for this population, used a one-page redetermination form that is much easier for this population to deal with and has the added benefit of that they actually fill it out and send it back, so we don't have as much churning in that caseload of people's cases being closed because they didn't fill out the 30-page form. So, speaking from a county perspective, the items in this bill are critical to us in our efforts to streamline and simplify our processing and ensure accuracy.
Okay, we have a couple questions. Representative Hayden, do you want
to? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Fleissner and Ms. Nelson. I thank you for bringing this bill. As a former financial worker, there was a little bit of PTSD I had in looking at all of the work that I used to have to do, especially the Uncle Harry information. Yeah, or I used to have to try to figure that out. So I think that these simplifications, and really, frankly, Mr. Chair, I know Representative Slawick has talks about this a lot, that the systems that we use are really outdated and antiquated. Mr. Fleissner also alluded to that, and we don't really have the budget at this particular time to really kind of redo Maxis and Prism and MMIS, but it is surely overdue. I guess the question I have for Ms. Nelson is, it's my understanding that even in Ramsey County, you have a group of clerks, workers, that just simply correct all of the errors that are made, or all of the things that weren't caught or errors that are made each month on some of your systems. Can you talk a little bit about that, if you know, or kind of what that looks like? And if you don't, I'll tell you what I think.
Ms. Nelson, you can get the first shot at it.
We don't actually have a group of staff who work just on errors. So I'm not picking up on exactly what you're.
Well, I guess what I'm going, Mr. Chair.
They don't make errors there, Representative.
Well, I know that they don't. I wanted to correct the errors, but the.
You were from a different department.
There's a group of folks that I know, and I have some people that I know that work, and I don't know what the technical term is, but it simply is just to figure out how to make the system work. So no matter if they're errors or their messages that haven't got caught or things that don't quite make sense, there's a group of people that look into the database that don't see clients, that don't work with people, that just have to kind of make the system work with each other. So I'm not sure exactly what the group is called, but
the message is not got department. Yeah,
right,
that's
exactly
a different one. Name.
Representative, we do have people who are constantly reviewing our data to make sure that it matches up, so that we don't have mismatches in data between, for example, the Maxis system and the eligibility system for medical, which is the MMIS system, because otherwise you're either paying premiums for people you shouldn't be or not paying for premiums for people you should be. So we certainly have people who are working on an ongoing basis on reviewing error reports that we get and mismatch reports and that kind of thing.
So I guess, Mr. Chair, the point is that we're paying folks just to make sure that the systems work together. So to start a process like this, and hopefully one that's bigger, I think that there are long-term implications and savings in terms of our staff if we're able to link those systems together.
We have a couple other questions, too. But Mr. Fleissner, does this list go away if this bill becomes law and gets implemented?
Chairman Abler, representatives, no, not yet. I think some of the system changes give us more tools to deal with the current system, but no, these are actually out of the DHS manual for what we do, and this is a 2006 list. I'm sure the current is longer, no, we still have more work to do.
Well, but Ms. Flood, how much of a dent does this, if this becomes implemented next year or whatever, how much of a dent does this make in your...
Well,
in your operations,
I think in terms of our operational effectiveness, as I think about these kinds of systems, like Mary mentioned, the one change alone was three people in her shop, which means maybe it's a half a person in my shop. Yep. As we start gaining some of that, it certainly helps us with the current workflow. It's hard to put a total number on it, but I think, in general, we'd be swimming upstream a little better than we are. Part of the dilemma is that when you've got 25% increases in the caseload coming in the front door, it's hard to know how much we're gaining. But this definitely is a step in the right direction.
Okay. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And along those lines, I think this is a great bill. Mm-hmm. And so I want to thank Representative Mack for bringing this forward. If this, even though we have to cut a lot of money, Mr. Chair, I hope you can do this one. My question is around the fiscal note. They did pass it out. It looks like it's only $151,000, and I see that Kate Wolf is sitting in the audience, and Jenny Ernst, and a lot of people that have signed off on some of these. What I'm wondering is, we have fiscal notes, but Representative Mack, is this really doable? Can they do this? Because we've asked for a lot of this over the years and not had it. So I'm wondering.
Let's have them come down. Ms. Wolf going to come down, and unless Representative Mack, you can respond to.
No, I'll let the folks in the department respond. And just seeing the fiscal note for only 3 minutes, I'm not well versed in it yet, but I'll let them speak to it for the moment.
We still have to hear from Mr. Searle, too, so we're not going to, we haven't forgotten, and there's one more question lined up. So, Ms. Wolf, do you want to come down? And we want to ask you a few questions, please.
Mr. Chair, this seems very reasonable, doesn't it? For
well, yeah, it seems like the value pack here.
Yeah,
so
what, definitely.
Yeah. Sure. If you can clear out, is there room for all you there? Maybe the page can maybe help them get another chair or something. Thank you, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kate Wolf from the Department of Human Services. The total for the fiscal note is $151,000 for fiscal year 12. There are ongoing costs of $29,000 a year. The larger costs of the first fiscal year are for the development implementation and for sending notices where it would affect clients' eligibility or benefits. A portion of that, $35,000, is for the MAXA system costs for the provision for automating child support. And that has to do with taking the information that we currently get from PRISM, dividing it up, and basically automating the procedure that the county financial workers must do right now, which is dividing the costs up among the family members, and then entering that into the budgeting for the other programs that the family members are on. So it would not only relieve the labor of the county workers in dividing that up, but also in doing the budgeting for other programs, and could have a positive impact on our food support error rate, because this is a high error area for food support.
President Slavik, do you want
to? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Wolf, I remember extensive, we have had a lot of meetings about Maxis and about the computer systems. And then I sit on State Government Finance, which is chaired by Representative Lanning. I mean, we talk about there being a long-term technology plan where we're going to get everything working the way we want. Is Maxis system going to be around for a while?
Maxis system isn't likely to be, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Slavik. The Maxis system isn't likely to be replaced in whole anytime soon. The department's goal is to try to modernize components of it. And as you know, we do have an enterprise architecture approach, and we're trying to look at the variety of systems we have. We do have four major systems within the department. All of them are aging to one degree or another. Maxis is the oldest. MMAS is not far behind. And PRISM is also in need of modernization. SSIS is a little younger, but they are also undergoing some major work. There is a lot of strain on all of our systems because our populations continue to grow. We all deal with the complications. I mean, as the other testifiers have pointed out, our programs are very complicated and continue to get more complicated, and that places a lot of strain on both the systems and its users. And so what we're trying to do is come up with a sensible strategic approach, doing it piece by piece, because the cost of replacing all of our major systems would be enormous. Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Wolf. Good to hear from you. A question I have for you on the IT development part of that, is that done with internal staff, or is this a contracted out expense?
Ms. Wolf.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I believe all of the work that is laid out in this bill would be done in-house.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wolf, well, you already have those employees working for the department, so why would, and they're already having a salary and being paid for their regular expenses, so why would this be now an expenditure on here?
Ms. Wolf.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, we aren't staffed fully to do the kind of development that needs to be done. And what we do basically is staff a little bit beyond what we're budgeted for in our base appropriation, so that in order to do this kind of work, we can assign the staff we currently have. If we didn't take that approach, we would have to hire new staff, which means we would have 6 to 9 months of ramping up just to train the people in before they could begin work. So the cost of doing any system change and the implementation time would be much greater than what it is now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Wolf. Thank you for that. That's helpful information. But I also see an ongoing expenditure in 13, 14, 15. And so I can understand that you would maybe program and have that initial programming done in that way, but I see an additional 3 years of a half of an FTE. And what would be the justification for that ongoing expense?
I think there are two
systems. Oh, introduce yourself, please. And get close to the mic there if you can. Yeah, thank you.
Sorry.
Okay.
My name is Jenny Ernst, Department of Human Services. There are some additional FTEs, 1.5 FTEs, that are non-systems related in this fiscal note. One is to staff the requirements in Section 9, which requires that we develop a set of recommendations to align eligibility across our programs. And as you know, our programs are very complicated, and that's a very huge undertaking. It also requires that we draft legislative language related to aligning those programs and report back to the legislature. So that's one FTE that we're asking for, because that's outside the scope of our current work. And there is a half FTE in the healthcare area that is related to Section 10. which also requires us to do some work in simplifying the process to determine eligibility and to send out review forms. And that's a half a position.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your patience as I follow the train of thought and thinking that that's helpful information. I think the other question I have, though, is for the county folks and in regards to what's going on here. Because I heard you say the word savings, but in here, it says on the fiscal note that there is no local fiscal impact. Usually, I would suppose you might think of that being a cost to you locally, but it seems as though what I hear you saying is that this would provide savings for you. Have savings for you, the effect of reducing the administrative burden on the county. So this would be an expense to the state, an additional expense, but it would be savings for you in the county administration-wise. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman Nabler and Representative Kiffmeyer, from our perspective, I believe we would save some FTEs if we streamline policy and we modernize our technology. And so, yes, I believe this kind of policy change would lead to savings at the county level and eventually at the state level since we – or, no, I guess it would be federal level because of the match. But and I think you would agree with that.
Chairman Abler and Representative Kiffmeyer, yes, there's definitely a savings at the county level. The difficulty, I think, is that it's saving us time so that we can more effectively deal with our caseload growth. Yeah. It isn't saving us positions that would no longer be on the books, if that makes sense to you. So the savings for us here is in making us more efficient and able to deal with a larger caseload without any additional staff, as opposed to cutting staff.
This helps you go out of business a little more slowly. Mr. Searle, do you want to? I don't want to overlook your commentary, so welcome to the committee, and I think this is a good discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Newell Searle. I'm the Vice President at Second Harvest Heartland. Second Harvest Heartland is a regional hunger relief organization. We operate a food bank, but we also engage in outreach to help applicants fill out their application for SNAP or the food support program. We are a partner with DHS in the state's outreach plan, and we have outreach workers in a number of counties, including Ramsey, where we've had quite a partnership, Anoka, Wright, Hennepin, Blue Earth, Brown, and several others. We support this bill because we support the idea of streamlining the process of administering the SNAP program. This is the one we are familiar with. We also recognize that SNAP is connected in its administration and through its staff with many other programs. So our interest in SNAP is a very narrow one, but we recognize it has implications for the administration of the other programs as well, particularly health care and child care. As we looked kind of globally at how do you prevent hunger in Minnesota and how much hunger is there, we recognize that the
charitable sector could do only so much, and then we would run out of money and capacity. But we also looked and saw that SNAP, or food support, was still an underutilized resource, largely because of administrative barriers and administrative costs. So we support the streamlining because it will improve customer service. We're also confident, based on our experience with county financial service workers, it will save the county's money. The Food and Nutrition Service of USDA published a report in June on the modernization of the food support program nationally, and state after state is in the same, or has been through, the same situation that we are at the present moment. Simplifying, finding efficiencies, changing business practices, and improving customer service. So we are in the mix with a lot of other states. And Wisconsin, I might add, is a state where we also do food support outreach. They have an automated online system, and so we can compare and contrast the experience of what we do here with what they do there.
Questions for Mr. Searle? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is maybe for any of the testifiers, not specifically for that. And thank you for that testimony. But, you know, I recall ever since, I'm from Olmsted County, so Mr. Fleissner works for Olmsted County, and I've been hearing about these issues ever since I was elected. I mean, I remember having a tour over there and learning about this maybe as soon as I was elected, maybe one of the first things I learned about the county, in fact. And I know that work's been done on this, and there have been efforts to solve these problems, and we're just sitting here kind of racking our brains, and because we know that there were efforts to try to solve some of these problems. And I know that the Pawlenty administration, when I was first elected, they were talking about the drive to excellence and how they were going to reform government and fix all the computer systems that didn't talk to each other. And I don't know if that applied to the counties or not. But so I just wonder if somebody can tell me what happened. Why hasn't this been fixed? Because it's certainly been a problem. And we're thinking maybe there was a higher fiscal note for some of this and we couldn't afford to do some of the changes. Or I don't know if somebody from the department can tell us why, or Mr. Fleissner, if you recall what happened to the proposals.
Can someone tell us why?
Chairman Abler, Representative Liebling, yeah, as I say, my quest has not been a very successful one. I have been... As I've gone down this path, it's been stopped in many ways. One is, it's pretty quick to kill anything with a fiscal note. Also, a lot of programs, quite honestly, in our state were created because of a single situation or a few situations. And so you see that list of six pages of stuff, a lot of them built off of that. And there's a constituency behind every one. I know I tried to take some of this to the Administrative Simplification Committee, which met twice and died. And you know, I don't know why it died, but I don't know. If not now, when is my question. If not now, when? Because we're desperate. We're drowning in clients. We can't serve them as well as we'd like. And I think we need to find a way to both simplify and modernize. And I don't think we have a choice. I think as systems melt down, I'd rather do it before we're in complete crisis mode. So.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I think I'll take as many questions as there are, but it's time for us to just move in. So, yeah, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say I support doing that, and I've supported it for a long time. And so that's why I'm asking a question. Yeah, but I absolutely support the effort. We need to do it.
Mm-hmm. I think you have a lot of fans. Representative Mack, it's the last word, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As it was said, I think this is obviously a complicated issue. There's lots of aspects that need to be fixed, and it certainly isn't cheap. But I think the appetite is there for finding extreme creativity in how to get this to work. There's a lot of mind power in the counties who have boots on the ground every day. I know there's a lot of ideas out there. There's obviously ideas and plans within the department. I'm looking for creative ways that we can minimize the cost by bringing together the meeting of the minds, bringing together good ideas. I know they're out there, so I'm committed to it and invite anyone to become a part of the discussion to see if we can make some significant progress in the near future. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate it.
Bill, I don't think you answered the question why for us today, however, but we'll have to work on the whys tomorrow. Tomorrow, just to announce to the public and to the members what's going to happen in the next 10 days or so. Tomorrow, I'm going to bring as much policy language as I can conjure up from the work we've been doing. Many ideas will be common to the past. Some are a bit new. All have been developed in association with some public entity somewhere. Some are anonymous. Some are, I hope. And so we'll go through that. We have our hour for tomorrow, and we have the evening available should we need it. And we'll make that decision as a group if we decide to come back or not to hear more about it. Thursday is a bunch of bills, each and every one a quality bill, no doubt. I don't even know what we're doing. But and then next week on Tuesday, we'll be Monday at 12:30 officially. We'll be electronically releasing the omnibus bill. It will be so I don't know, wherever that is online, my son could find it. And so Tuesday afternoon at 12:30, we'll be going through it live. There'll be hard copies available up in our corner Tuesday morning. I don't know what time. Oh, not Tuesday morning. Probably noon. Okay. They'll be electronically available at noonish or whenever they can get done. We're not trying to stall. And then Wednesday there'll be public testimony, which will be our hour and in the evening, I think. And then Thursday we'll be marking up the bill. We have both slots available and the evening if we need it. And we don't. Oh, sorry, we just have our time, then there's the floor, and then we'll be having the evening if we need that. Anyway, there's a, try to have your amendments with a 24-hour rule. You'll have electronically be available, I think, 2 days ahead, but at least have them well in the pipeline. Representative Slawa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. Again, I sit on State Government Finance, and Maury Lanning, Representative Lanning, Chair Lanning, offered the minority a chance to meet with him. I just wondered if you're going to offer us a chance to meet with you.
If you'd like. I'd be happy to do that. I've just been so jammed. I've been talking to Representative Huntley for a month, just the two of us, but I would be happy to. And maybe Andy can get that put together, even this week, just to kind of let you know what directions there are. That would be more productive than. Oh, is it? Would you think Monday's soon enough, or do you want it this week?
Well, we met today, and it was very helpful, but with Chair Lanning, so I don't
Why
know.
Why don't you, well, Andy has my calendar, so if you can get your lead person, or yeah, somebody can put together with Andy, and I will come. Yeah, so Luke and Andy will put together a meeting. And Representative Slawa.
I just had another question. Is tomorrow, I thought we go us, and then we're meeting both with the policy committee, and we're meeting together.
As a joint meeting.
Is that a whole meeting together?
Oh, excuse me. Yeah. Okay, so there's a...
It's complicated.
I feel like I'm doing post op. Why don't you just say so there'll be a joint meeting at this hour will be a joint meeting. And then Reform has the meeting to do their whole time together as a Reform meeting. And then we come back in the evening joint again. Should we decide to come back. And that'll be a decision that if enough of you want to come back, we'll come back. If you have had enough and you're satiated, then that will be fine. So that would be 8 o'clock. So it's because it's there's caucus, and I think it'll be lengthy. You know that feeling. So with that, thank you for your good attendance. Thanks to the public, and we're adjourned.